This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Hello, this is Deborah Emerson, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen through your phone by calling 760-569-7676. Then, when prompted, enter access code 1929-19#. Or, if you have a computer or smartphone, go to www.bbsradio.com and navigate to Station 2 and click on the Listen icon. You can also call in with questions for our guest toll-free in the United States and Canada at 888-429-5471. Our special guest tonight on The People Speak is Shadow Senator Michael D. Brown from the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. Senator Brown was elected in 2006 with 84% of the vote. He serves the people of the District of Columbia as an advocate for statehood and equal rights and has served with distinction, receiving an award in 2010 from a coalition of activist groups, including the ACLU, for his contribution to the statehood movement. He'll also be hosting his own show here on BBS Radio called Shadow Politics, starting April 14th, every Sunday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard, 7 p.m. Eastern on Station 2. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you, Deborah. Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's great to talk to you.
Well, we're excited here. We're excited about the show that's going to start on April 14th.
Yes. I'm so excited about it.
Yeah, and, you know, this is going to be a grassroots talk show where we hear what people out there in America think about the issues that are going on here in Washington. So we're very excited about that.
Well, great. Well, I know when I first talked to you, I had no idea what a shadow senator was about. So if you could just define what exactly a shadow senator is and how did you become one, and maybe a little history behind it.
Sure. Well, first of all, we're an endangered species. There's only two of us currently. But the office goes way, way back. It started actually in 1796 in Tennessee when Tennessee was a territory and they wanted to become a state. They elected two United States senators and sent them to Washington. And when they arrived in Washington, they pulled up a couple of chairs on the Senate floor. And these two guys, Senator Blount and Senator Cock, came in and they lobbied for Tennessee to have statehood, which it eventually got. And since that time, many other states have used the same method called the Tennessee Plan. Michigan used it, California, Minnesota, Oregon, Alaska. And in the 1980s, when the District of Columbia decided it wanted to become a state, it did the same thing. It elected in 1991, after a constitutional convention, it elected two United States senators, the first one being Jesse Jackson. I became shadow senator in 2006. As you said, I got 84% of the vote and just was recently reelected with 207,000 votes, which is more votes than either senator from Alaska or Wyoming or North Dakota. So we're elected the same way all senators are. We just don't have a voice in the legislature. Our job is basically to lobby for statehood. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I understand that your main goal is to get Washington, D.C. recognized as the 51st state.
Yes.
Why do you want to do this, and how are you going to do this?
Well, the reason we want to do it is it's really the only thing that makes the people of the District of Columbia equal. A lot of people may not know this, but in the district, we have no voting member of Congress. Even though we spend the most in terms of federal taxes. We pay the highest per capita federal taxes in the nation. We serve at higher than the national average. We've served in every armed conflict that the United States has ever been in. We don't have any voice in our own legislature. We don't have control over our local budget, which needs to be approved by Congress and signed by the president. And we don't have control over our local legal system. So the way to make the people of the district equal is to make them a state, because all states are equal. If we do anything else, if we legislate, for example, that we were to have two senators and a congressman, that could always be taken away by Congress. So statehood is the answer to make the people of the District of Columbia equal after 210 years of good citizenship. And we're going about it and by using the Tennessee plan, which I explained briefly, with shadow senators. And we have two bills now before Congress. One is in the House of Representatives, which I found out today has 25 co-sponsors, and one is in the United States Senate, which has 4 co-sponsors. And if they pass both houses and are signed by the president, the district would, in fact, become the 51st state. So that's what we're doing right now. We're pushing hard to get those two pieces of legislation through the House and the Senate.
Okay. And it's confusing. Is Washington, D.C. the same thing as the District of Columbia? And where did the word Columbia come from?
Well, the District of Columbia and Washington are, in fact, the same. We see them, we call the capital Washington, but it is Washington, D.C. And, Columbia comes from, it's a word that was used in early America to describe many things. So the District of Columbia is actually described in the United States Constitution, which says that the capital of the United States shall be a district no greater than 10 miles square. So that's where the whole district thing comes from. But if we make the District of Columbia a state, what we would do would be to take the area which is now the government buildings, the mall area, the Capitol, the White House, and they would remain the nation's capital. They would remain Washington, and the new state would be all the other surrounding area, which is populated, and that would become the state of New Columbia.
Interesting. Well, what's the incentive for the average person of this country to support Washington, D.C. as the 51st state?
Well, that's a good question, and I guess it depends on your perspective. If you believe, as Dr. Martin Luther King did, and as I do, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, then we all have a vested interest in a just society. In the District of Columbia, this is evidenced by the fact that several laws in the District of Columbia have led the way for laws across the United States. Today, there was a case before the Supreme Court on marriage equality. Washington, D.C. was one of the first cities in America to have a marriage equality law. So in the district, we very often set the tone for national politics, and so we all have a vested interest in making the nation's capital not only strong, but allowing us to have a voice in the discussion. Here in the district, we not only make policy, but we represent all sorts of public interest groups, from AARP to nurses and doctors and unions and all sorts of causes. And for us not to be part of the dialogue, I think, makes America lesser. And if you believe that, then there's a vested interest in all of us making sure that the people of the District of Columbia are equal, just like everybody else.
Yes,
it really is the principle on which our country was founded.
Yes. And what do you have to do with the Women League of Voters?
Well, the League of Women Voters is actually a national organization that started during the suffragists, movement to get women to vote. So, of course, the League of Women Voters is interested in getting everybody to vote. There are 630,000 disenfranchised people in the District of Columbia, and approximately half of those are women. So women have the right to vote, and they have equal rights with men, at least institutionally, across America, except in the District of Columbia. So the local League of Women Voters has been very supportive of our effort.
And do you work hand-in-hand with them, Michael?
Well, we work with a lot of groups. There's a coalition of groups, and yes, they're a member of the coalition. There's a public interest group in Washington called DC Vote, which pulls together many public interest groups around the country, including the League of Women Voters, the NAACP, the National Urban League, groups like that that are interested in civil rights. And yes, the League is a member of that group, and we work closely with the League, yes.
And if Washington, D.C. is elevated to a state in this country or of the country, will you be recognized as a full senator with all the privileges and responsibilities?
Well, somebody will. Don't know if it'll be me, but in the past, the other six states that have used shadow senators, that's exactly what's happened. The shadow senator has become the full-fledged senator from that state with all the rights of a senator. Now, in the District of Columbia, that it might require a special election, and I believe that's the way the Constitution set up, that once we're a state, there would be a special election. In the cases of the other states, they had their elections before they became states. So the answer to your question is, I wouldn't necessarily become the senator, but there would be two senators from the the District of Columbia.
But would you not be the shadow senator, or?
Right, the shadow senator office goes with when we become a state. That's right. And in fact, my first campaign slogan when I ran the first time was Michael Brown, the last shadow senator you'll ever need. Because that's what I really wanted to be. I wanted to be the last. Rather than be the first real senator, I wanted to be the last shadow senator.
Yes, yes.
You also
mentioned that the people in the District of Columbia have a limited right to vote for the president.
Yeah, actually, the more you look into this, the more insidious it gets in a lot of ways. And the District of Columbia didn't have a vote for president until the 1960s. Lyndon Johnson was the first president that we ever got to vote for in the District of Columbia because of the 23rd Amendment to the Constitution. But that amendment says that the District of Columbia should have no more votes than the smallest states in the Electoral College. And we all know the Electoral College is what ultimately elects the president. So, for example, if the population of the District of Columbia were to become 2 million people, we would still only have 3 votes because Wyoming has 3 votes and they're the smallest state. So everywhere else, it's based on population. In the District of Columbia, it's a set number which diminishes our votes because we may, in fact, have way more people then we have votes, if that makes sense to you. Everywhere else is based on population. In the District of Columbia, it's legislated to be no greater than the smallest state.
And if there's a tie?
And if there's a tie, we have no vote. All our votes are nullified because ties go into Congress, and your members of Congress get to vote for who the next president is, and since we have no voting member of Congress, we have no vote. And in this last election, where we voted almost 90% for President Obama, and we cast well over 300,000 votes, none of those votes would have counted if it went into the House, and the House of Representatives needed to decide.
This is very surprising.
It is. We're the only country in the world that actually does this. There's
there any
no other
country?
Democracy. I'm sorry?
Is there any other country?
No other country does this. At one time, South Africa also did it, but they've evolved over the years, and now they don't treat the residents of their capital any different than the rest of the people in the country. And we're the only country in the world that does this. And strangely enough, 10 other nations have used our constitution as a framework for their own constitutions, and in every case, in all 10 cases, they've removed that clause, which we call the district clause, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which prohibits the, which gives the power to control the capital to the national legislature. They've all removed that clause. So we're the only country in the world that does this. And actually, it comes back to haunt us from time to time. We used to have a great supporter for voting rights in the District of Columbia, Jack Kemp, who's a former cabinet secretary and was a congressman. And he said when he went to China on a trade mission and they wanted to talk about equal rights or civil rights in China, the first thing the Chinese said to him is, don't lecture us when you don't allow the people of your capital city to even vote. So it's a strange thing for us to spread democracy around the world without having it here at home.
Absolutely. It's very surprising to me, and I think most people would not realize this.
Yes, and it's terrible. You know, there are lots of aspects to this, but I think the most distressing is that over 200,000 people in the District of Columbia have served during wartime, and 5,000 of them have been victims of that service. We have over 30 Congressional Medal of Honor winners, and all these soldiers, if they returned home, were treated like second-class citizens. In fact, last year, a group on Capitol Hill tried to take away the city's World War I memorial that we had built with our own money. Actually, the money was collected by school children, and we had built this memorial with the names of all the fallen from the District of Columbia, and there was a movement last year to nationalize the monument and make it the National World War I memorial. We had to fight that to keep it from happening.
Well, I'm glad you fought the fight.
Yes, we are,
Michael,
too.
We have a caller on line one. His name is Nader, and he has a question for us.
Sure.
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I was calling to question about the non-tax federal tax-paying employees with inside the state of the Washington, D.C. area and District of Columbia.
Great
question. Why are they not paying taxes?
Well, they do pay taxes. Everybody pays federal taxes, but in the case of the District of Columbia, if you work outside the city, if you live outside the city and you work in the District of Columbia, you don't have to pay any taxes to the District of Columbia. Now, this is a very unusual situation. If you lived in New Jersey and you worked in New York, you'd have to pay some tax to New York. And that would be credited against your New Jersey income tax. So what happens is that people that live outside the city don't pay state income tax to the District of Columbia. We lose in excess of $2 billion a year because of this, and 70% of the people that work in the district live outside the District of Columbia. So this is a real problem for us. We lose a lot of money because of this. But everybody that works in the district pays taxes.
And I have one more question, and that question is, with the District of Columbia being a state, would it make people, would it bring the politicians under state jurisdiction in case of, say, for instance, a political crime or something of that nature? Would that put the government officials under state jurisdiction?
No, not necessarily. Not the federal government officials. And this was a concern when the district was first formed more than 200 years ago, that there may be undue influence from the states, but from the state that it occupied. But that has long since passed. And what our plan would be to consolidate the nation's capital into what we call the National Capital Service Area, which is all the government buildings, the White House, the Capitol, the mall area, and that would all remain the nation's capital. So those people would still be under the jurisdiction of the capital of the United States, Washington, D.C. But they would also come under local jurisdiction the way they do now. You know, if you're a congressman and you speed through the District of Columbia, a district cop can pull you over and give you a ticket. So that would still be the case. But the nation's capital would be independent of the state of New Columbia.
And my last question to you, sir, is what is your stance on the Second Amendment? And do you believe in a Second Amendment and keeping it righteous for the American people?
Well, I'm a believer in the Second Amendment, and I think we're believers in the District of Columbia in the Second Amendment. But unfortunately, we've had our gun laws overturned by a thing called the Heller decision in front of the Supreme Court because they said our gun laws were too strict. So I'm one of those people that believes that Americans have the right to bear arms, but I also believe that right needs to be tempered with some responsible legislation, and we need to ban assault weapons and these clips that hold 30 rounds of ammunition and all this stuff that seems to be over the top to me. But as a right for people to bear arms, yes, it's the Second Amendment of the Constitution, and it should be we should take it very seriously.
Right, but that Second Amendment has no restrictions on guns whatsoever or the bearing of arms, because we do have the right to form a militia, so they shouldn't be touched at any given moment for any given reason.
Well, that would make it
that
would make it a constitutional amendment that stands alone, and that doesn't make sense to me. There is no constitutional amendment. There is no amendment to the Constitution which is inviolate. There is no constitutional amendment which is above which has no restrictions on it. For example, the First Amendment to the Constitution says that you have the right to freedom of speech, but you are not allowed to stand up in a crowded room and scream fire. There are limits on all the amendments to the Constitution, and there should be limits to the Second Amendment as well.
That's my opinion. It doesn't state that in the Constitution that it's to be there with limitations. It states singly that we have the right to bear arms, and it doesn't state that there can be any limitations on it in the Constitution.
Well, it doesn't state that there can be any limitations on freedom of speech either. There's no specific thing that says in the Constitution that you can't scream fire in a crowded theater. It's the court's interpretation of the First Amendment that's made that the law of the land. And by the same token, the Second Amendment says that the federal government should not do anything to abridge your right to bear arms. It doesn't say to abridge your right to bear any kind of weapon you want. It says to abridge your right to bear arms. So as long as we felt that we were in compliance by allowing people in the district to have shotguns but not have handguns, and the Supreme Court found through the Heller decision that found against us and said no, we had to allow people to have handguns.
Michael?
Well, I'm in agreement. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm in agreement with the court's decision because there should not be any restrictions placed on anything. The only time restrictions should be put in place is on people that lost their rights by being felons and things of that nature. The laws that are put in place are doing nothing but making it harder for the good standing citizens to enjoy the recreation that they enjoy.
Well, it's not a matter of recreation,
sir.
Yeah, 20 babies murdered in Connecticut by a law-abiding citizen, okay? His mother was a member of the NRA. He didn't have a criminal record. He went out and killed 20 babies. You need to draw the line somewhere. It's not about taking guns away from sportsmen. It's not about taking guns away from people that want to protect themselves. But it's about regulating something that's dangerous in our society the way we regulate everything that's dangerous in our society.
Okay,
look, I own a car.
How do we need to follow our constitutional laws and form a militia when the government is no longer working for the people? How are we to do that if there's restrictions on us not being able to have what we want to have?
Well, therein lies
part of the constitutional guarantee.
Well, therein lies the problem. The problem is that the people that advocate for this are not people that want to protect themselves. They're people that are afraid of the government. Well, the government in the district, in the government in the United States of America, is made up of the people. It's the people's government. So this paranoid attitude that some gun owners have about protecting themselves from the government so that they can form a militia, this rule to the Constitution was written in the 1700s when militias made sense. Nobody's going to form a militia. Let me tell you, I live here in the District of Columbia, and I don't care how bad you think you are or what kind of armament you have, you cannot stand up to the United States Marine Corps. They are tough guys.
We know that.
So,
we know that.
Okay, so it becomes a moot point to form a militia because we don't need to form militias.
Well,
thank you,
you're right there,
We're going to have to pause for a second.
And we'll have to agree to disagree, I guess.
Yes. Thank you for your call, Nader.
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
And, Michael, shortly we're going to pause for a break, but before we pause, I wanted to ask you how our audience can help you with your campaign to make Washington, D.C. a state. Are there any special websites, petitions?
Yeah, that's a great question, Deborah. And two of the things they can do. One thing, they can go to our website, which is www.statehoodnow.org. And the .org is very important because statehoodnow.com will take you to Puerto Rico, who also wants to become a state. But the District of Columbia, their website is statehoodnow.org, and as soon as you go on, it will show you there are all sorts of buttons that will show you how to get involved and about the history of the struggle. But there's also one that says sign the petition. And if you just click sign the petition, you can go in and sign our petition.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break and be right back with our guest, Shadow Senator Michael Brown from Washington, D.C. This is The People Speak.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
To build, to destroy.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana, and it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Welcome back to The People Speak, and if you're just joining us, this is your host, Deborah Emerson, with our guest tonight, Shadow Senator Michael D. Brown, advocating statehood and equal rights for the District of Columbia in Washington. Senator, we have a really special caller on the line for you tonight.
Okay.
And it's my pleasure to introduce him to all of you listening. It's a host of a rapidly growing show gaining more and more of a listening audience. He's a teacher by profession, a student of politics, a poet of language, and the host of the very popular show here on BBS Radio called History and You, airing every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard. May I welcome Mr. George Rodriguez Walling. Hello, George. How are you?
Hey, George. How are you?
Good.
Good.
To be here with you, sir.
Yeah, thanks for calling in.
George, may I say today that your show on BBS Radio was so powerful, raw, and honest.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very, very much.
So I encourage anybody who missed that show today, History and You at 4 p.m., to go back to the archives in a couple days and try and listen to it. It was just the most moving show. But at any rate, you had a riveting show with the senator on your show last week, and there's just not enough time to cover all the topics you wanted, so go ahead.
Thank you so much. And, you know, it's people like yourself that, you know, show constant support. And that's a tremendous boost for myself or anybody in my position that really wants to move forward with this. And, of course, tremendous guests like the senator makes it all the easier. Hence the reason why I decided to call in and talk to the senator. Once I found out he was on, I go, oh, boy, I got to try. I got to continue with my conversation with the senator.
Yes, well
thanks,
you, George.
Thanks for calling in, George. And let me just echo what Deborah said. Yeah, we had a great show last week, and I encourage everybody to listen to your show. It's a really good show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator.
So what question can I answer for you today, George?
Well, several.
Okay.
Things that we just left off last time. I wanted to Senator, to pick up on your arrest. You were arrested based on civil disobedience over a particular bill. You want to tell us what that was all about?
Yeah, you know that one of the things that we don't have control over here is our own budget, which is so locally raised tax money. We have to have our budget approved by Congress before we can spend the money. And in the budget 2 years ago, there was a provision that took money away from medical procedures for poor women in the District of Columbia. And we objected to it because in no other state, it didn't apply to any state. It only applied to the District of Columbia. So several of us went out in the street, actually 74 of us in total, and
including
we protested.
The mayor?
The mayor, yes. The mayor and many members of the city council were arrested on April, I think it was April 12th. And I was arrested on April 15th, which is tax day. As you can imagine, the people in the District of Columbia love tax day because we pay all these federal taxes, and then we have no voice in our national legislature. Yeah. So we pretty much always protest on the 15th or the 16th.
Now, Senator, what I wanted to ask you at this point is if that money was taken away for the areas that you stated for people in need for medical services, where was that money shifted to? Was it shifted to another area that the federal government felt it needed a higher priority, or was it just removed and taken away?
It was just removed. It was a rider put on our budget, and that happens all the time. And they really don't redistribute the funds, and they really don't look over our budget and try to see where the money is best used. What they do is if they find something objectionable in our budget, they take it out. The clearest example is a needle exchange program. We put in a needle exchange program 10 years ago to help stop the spread of AIDS in the District of Columbia, which had become rampant. Well, for 10 years, every year, the Congress took the money that we had put in to the budget to perform needle exchange. They took it out so that we couldn't have a needle exchange program. They didn't allow us to use the money for needle exchange. They didn't say we had to use it for anything else. They
well,
just
what
said,
was the rationality
no.
behind it, though?
But they didn't like the idea of needle exchange. They thought that they thought there were certain members of Congress that thought that it promoted drug use.
Michael,
so they had it taken out. And that's the problem in the District of Columbia. Any congressman from anywhere can do whatever they want in the District of Columbia because Congress controls the district.
All right. Well, Senator, let me at this point play the devil's advocate, if only for a moment.
Can I interrupt you for just a second? We do have a caller that's waiting to talk to the senator. Can I put him on or her on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air.
I'm on the air now?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. Very good. Mr. Shadow Senator?
Yes.
I'd like to know how you would handle the public school problem in Washington, D.C., and I would like to remind you of Michelle Rhee, who was appointed by the mayor the chancellorship of the public schools in a very troubled state in 2007, where I think the 8% or less of the eighth graders actually could read at the or could do grade level mathematics, and she went in there with some very top down accountability methods to start to produce some results and to pull that horrible public school system out of the situation it's in. And within 2 years, I believe, between the city council and the teachers' union, they ousted her from that position and got rid of her. And I'd like to know, in times of economic tightening of the belt, tightening of budgets, serious financial issues, how we're to deal with a leviathan of politics that would actually stop a person who was so committed to the future of those children that she went out of her way to try to change one of the worst public school systems in the United States of America, and she was thrown out. I'd like to know what you would do to change that.
Well, that's a very good question, really. And what I would do is I'd make the District of Columbia state. Because one of the problems with our school system in the District of Columbia is that we have to wait to get our budget approved. Now, our budget is approved by Congress and the President of the United States, which includes an $800 million school budget. Now, we have to wait until sometimes October or November or December to get our budget approved. Imagine trying to run a school system that starts in August and then and not being able to have the money until October or November. This
Senator, would it be possible to attach a rider prioritizing that situation in respect to the young lady's question?
Well, I mean, if the federal government decided to attach the rider, certainly locally we do many things for education, but it really is up to the Congress whether those things take place or not and are instituted and whether money can be used for a particular purpose. And to give you a clear example, we have a school program here, a charter school program here, that was started by members of Congress, and we decided, the voters of the District of Columbia decided that they wanted to end the program a few years ago, and we weren't allowed to. The money was reallocated and the program goes on. So we don't have control over the education system in the District of Columbia. And the situation with Michelle Rhee was that Michelle Rhee left when we got a new mayor. There was disagreement in some of the things that she was doing. And when we elected the new mayor, we had a mayor that brought her on. But when the new mayor came on, she decided to leave. So she wasn't forced out.
Senator, I wanted to ask you, still as a follow-up to the young lady's question regarding mm-hmm. education in the D.C. area, mm-hmm. What about the programs that are already in place and so much money has been dedicated, has been funded toward that area, but these are programs that just do not work? In other words, these are programs that Congress pushed through without your approval or without your authorization, and they just don't work. How do you get rid of them? Because the problem of education isn't only limited to the D.C. area, but the D.C. area is probably one that reflects similar problems across the nation.
Well, you're right. It is a problem everywhere in the nation. And how we get rid of them, I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, we certainly are trying new, innovative things in the District of Columbia. And I'd be the first one to tell you that it's a disgrace that there are high schools in the District of Columbia with a 50%, 51% dropout rate, which means in the nation's capital, you're more likely in some high schools not to finish than you are to finish. So it is a major problem in the District of Columbia, and we've been fighting with it for years now. We've just had, we got rid of the school board, gave the power to run the school system to the mayor a few years ago, and now we have the city council taking on, there's a new committee on education, which is headed up by a DC council member, and what we're trying to do is wrestle with these issues right now. There's been new laws, there's been two new laws proposed in the last month to try to deal with truancy and, also, to, deal with the fact that, many third graders, are unable to read in the District of Columbia. It's true that there are many.
Senator, you mentioned innovative ways that you're trying to change the school system over there. Could you specify on some ways?
Well, I got to tell you, innovative, not necessarily, I don't say innovative that they're necessarily good ways. Always. There's one of the most recent pieces of legislation, for example, would allow us to hold children back. Now they can only be held back in certain grades. This would allow us to hold them back across the board until they got up to grade level. I'm not sure that that's a good idea, but it's a different idea, and
yeah,
it's being debated now. There's also a truancy law that would make parents responsible for their truant children. This is something that I don't agree with. But again, it's an attempt to try to flush these issues out, and they're now having a public debate about it.
Right. Now, Senator, with respect to the caller also, I think she brought up another important point, which touched sensitively with me as well, me being a teacher. With your ideas to innovate, redefine or reconfigure problems in the D.C. area within the schools. Let's go beyond the schools and into the classroom. How much power do teachers have in their schools in the D.C. area? Because it seems to me that a lot of the power as far as how instruction is to take place seems to start eclectically from various areas, such as either from Congress or from the mayor's office or from your office, or from the administration's office. It starts in various places except where it's supposed to start, with the teacher and the student in that classroom. So how much power, how much ability to redefine, forget education, let's talk about learning, redefining learning, how much power do these teachers have to be left alone and have them do what they probably know how to do best?
Well, this is a big problem in the District of Columbia. And this is the thing I like about you most, George, is that you do your homework. But this is a big problem in the District of Columbia. And teachers have been complaining about it for years, that we're a very administratively heavy school system, that principals have more power than teachers do in determining, you know, policies inside the school and things like staffing and where critical resources are spent. And teachers are very upset about it. And also in the District of Columbia, you know that there, I think there's one other school system, and that's Philadelphia, that's at the same level the district is in terms of charter schools. Almost half of all our children are in charter schools, which means that there's boards of parents that are making decisions.
Well, it simply
on how
means
these schools
that
should be run.
Schools are not working the way they should.
No, that's
like
right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So you can't, so it's hard, even though I'm an advocate for public schools, it's hard to stand there and say to mothers who have their children in failing schools that they shouldn't take them out and put them in charter schools. And that's exactly what's happening. And that's what we're struggling with right now to try to reach a balance. And I can tell you personally, I've been one of those people that always believes that you leave things to the experts, and the most expert person you can have in a school is a teacher.
Yeah, well, that's true, and for personal basis as well as personal bias, because I am a teacher as well. But there is another caveat here that everyone else has to be made aware of. It's not just teachers, Senator. It's good teachers, as opposed to those teachers that know how to milk the system so well from the inside out and in every other which way.
Yes,
you got to know how to select the good teachers that know what they are protesting about. You know that some people argue just for the sake of arguing. They
yes.
love to hear the sound of their own voice. But
yes.
other people argue to make a point. And when those teachers, the good ones, protest to make a point, they know what they're protesting about because the administration is trying to, in a futile attempt, futility, Senator, they try to reinvent the wheel, and it ain't working, and it's spending lost money that's going to go down the tubes sooner or later. And it's almost like a cyclical problem that just revisits itself over and over and over and over again.
Well, you know, we have this. This has been a constant struggle in the public education system. And one of the things that Michelle Rhee tried to do when she came in was to address this very problem that you talked about, getting rid of non-performing teachers and paying teachers who do perform, paying them extra and recognizing their superior work. And that was one attempt that she tried to make. And it's true that because she laid off lots of teachers who she thought were underperforming, the teachers union, of course, who has a vested interest in keeping as many teachers employed as possible, was up in arms about it, and she faced a lot of resistance. So it's something that we're struggling with right now.
You know, I'm willing to bet, Senator, that it's probably a lot of those really bad teachers that can care less about learning and care more about the vacation time and everything else that a school year brings. It's probably those bad teachers that just also disallow and feed into another huge problem with education, not only the D.C. area, but every place else, and that's the issue of teacher salaries. Because
yeah.
those teachers don't do what they are supposed to do, it affects the pool for everybody else, okay? And
George,
then, of course,
George, I need to
yeah.
We have Sarah on line 3. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Hi, Sarah.
I'm doing good. I've been listening to your show, and I just want to ask, why does the AIPAC lobby have such control over the two parties?
Well,
over both parties.
Well, you know, anybody with money in politics, let me just answer this as succinctly as I can. Anybody with money over in politics has power. Okay, whether it's AIPAC, whether it's the National Rifle Association, whether it's the American Medical Association, whoever it is. That's number one. And number two, the Israelis are our number one ally in the Middle East. So there's a great feeling on both sides of the aisle that Israel needs to be supported. And so AIPAC has a lot of power because of who it represents. And because it has money. And money...
Okay, so...
I'm sorry,
so
go ahead.
You're saying money and power... So, I'm sorry. You're saying money and power works.
Well, yeah, I'm saying that money and a constituency.
Just because, one party has money, is going to work. And the other one, since it doesn't have, so you per se, money, then the one that has all this has the power.
Well, not necessarily.
I'm trying to understand.
Well, that's not necessarily true. Certainly, Mitt Romney spent as much trying to get elected president as Barack Obama did. It's not all about money. But people that, in a capitalist society, people that have money and that have constituency, there's a lot of AIPAC has a lot of support in the United States. They bring in a lot of votes. If you're a union, you have the same kind of power. You know, if you're a member of a union because you control or at least can influence the votes of union members, you have a lot of control. You have a lot of power. And that explains AIPAC's power, I think, to a large extent in both parties, is that it has a large constituency inside the United States, and they're well off financially. I mean, look at the National Rifle Association. It's a tiny organization compared to AIPAC, and they have more control on both sides of the aisle.
That's what I was going to bring up very quickly.
Oh, my God. Okay, I guess I can take that. That's pretty sad, though, that, you know, money and power, you know, buys bullshit.
You know what?
I'm sorry.
You know what the counter to that is? The counter to that is to get involved. And unfortunately, in America, we're not engaged. We're not involved. Most of us don't even vote.
No.
So if you want to, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. If you're not out there, we have... One of the things I do is I train people that run for public office. And one thing that we say to them all the time is, if you're not at the table, you don't get served. So you need to be at the table, and you need to be like
you
are.
But the thing about it is, most of us that aren't rich, you know, that live comfortably, that we aren't rich, we don't have the power, we're the ones that stand in the friggin' lines and vote. I stood in even the last election, I stood 2 hours. That's what makes me so upset to hear money and power, you know, when it shouldn't be that way, because you'll take, I saw workers lined out the door to vote when I didn't see hardly anyone, you know, coming from the per se rich side to stand and cast their vote. I'm just saying the harder working people, I feel, work harder at trying to vote than others, you know, to make a change.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily true. I mean, if you look at statistics, old people vote more than young people, regardless of income. Wealthy people vote more than poor people. It's really not. The truth of the matter is that most of us don't vote, and we should vote, and we should be engaged, and we should hold our politicians accountable.
So you're telling me that more people should vote now, and it's not about the rich, that more people should vote, or is it both?
Well, you know what I'm saying?
Like, I'm getting confused.
Well, it's both. I mean, certainly money and power go hand in hand in a capitalist society. So to offset that, in order to counter it, you need votes. You need people. And in the bottom, you know, the bottom line is the person that gets the most votes wins the election. So when you talk about things like, term limits, I love this. People want term limits.
Right.
They want people not in there. Well, look, every congressman has a 2-year term limit. If you don't like them, vote them out.
I'm sorry.
Every senator has a 6-year term limit.
I'm sorry, everyone.
Yeah, I can understand voting out. I really can't. But, you know, it pretty much says, you know, if the people doesn't vote, it's not about the money, but, it's power to the lobby, power to the people to do this. But anyway, thank you for the question.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
And, George, thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, George.
No, not a problem. Senator, we still have to catch up on Obama, and I'm hoping to get you on the spot in my show at one point or another.
All right, well, I'll do some sit-ups and pull-ups and, you know, run a few miles to try to get in shape, George, and then I'll call into your show.
It's always very interesting to speak with you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me as well.
Thank you, George.
Thank you. Please tune in to History and You every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on BBS Radio Station 1. Next week, your regular host, Charles Giuliani, will be back with writer Michael Parenti, author of The Face of Imperialism. I'd like to thank our special guest, Shadow Senator Michael Brown from the District of Columbia in Washington. It was such a pleasure to have you with us, Michael.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show, and I very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Michael's website is www.shadowsenator.com, and you gave us your other website, correct?
Yeah, it's actually, that was my election website. You're better off going to statehoodnow.org.
Okay, thank you.
And okay, please, thank you.
And please, everyone, tune into his upcoming radio show called Shadow Politics, starting on April 14th, every Sunday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard, 7 p.m. Eastern on Station 2. And a final thanks tonight to the people behind the scenes that make it all happen, our wonderful engineers, Dawn and Doug Newsom at BBS Radio. Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office I saw my people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.